Hey, welcome to the Life 2.0 podcast. I'm John St. Augustine. Delighted to have you joining me one more time from all around the planet. It's time to go up the down staircase in the outdoor, try to make sense out of the senseless, and if at all possible, find the obvious buried in the absurd. Let's get to it. As I said, glad to have you joining me once again on the Life 2.0 podcast. This is a show I've been waiting years to do, not just in the podcasting arena. And I don't know if you can even do this in the, quote, terrestrial arena, but I've been in this business 25 years, and I have seen and heard things that I would love to talk about with somebody in the business and never had the opportunity to do that. And over time, since I got into radio in 1997, I've seen so many changes behind the scenes, especially when it comes to how do we grab an audience. You know, what goes into making people listen to a certain station or a certain host? And over time, how that has gotten more and more divided. And radio, in so many ways, is either a great uniter or a great divider, depending on who you're listening to. And I kind of hold along with the great late Fred Rogers, who said, the space between the host and the viewer or the listener is sacred. And I've always treated it as such, mostly because I've never went into radio thinking it would be a career for me. It was more of a calling. I don't take myself real serious, but I take these platforms that I've been given and the opportunities that I've been given and the microphones that I've been given as a very, very serious thing. Not everybody holds that, I think, in high esteem. So I have the opportunity today to spend time with a guy that I work with at WGN. There's a lot of really interesting and erratic characters in radio. He's just interesting, not erratic. I can tell you that right now. Chris Duffy has worked in radio for over 30 years, talk radio stations, as I mentioned, like WGN here in Chicago, WTAM in Cleveland, WJNO West Palm Beach, as well as nationally syndicated shows like Rush Limbaugh and Glenn Beck on the right to Randy Rhoads and Rachel Maddow on the left. He is currently a consultant and producer and voiceover artist based in Chicago, and he joins me on the Life 2.0 podcast. Hey, Chris.
John, pleasure to be with you.
You know, your voice, when I hear you, I want to buy stuff. the imaging, the voice imaging that you've done for so many stations over the years, you know, it's one of those very rare niches that people occupy. How did you get into this business?
You know what? When I was in high school up in the sticks in Traverse City, Michigan, I originally wanted to get into television, and I got accepted at Emerson College in Boston, which is a huge media school, very well-renowned media arts. And so my last year back home, I decided, well, you know, I want to get a well-rounded education in the business of media. So maybe I'll start with radio. And I did. And I did a year of radio up there, had a blast, had a lot of fun, learned, you know, the basics of going on the air and entertaining people. And then I went to college and started to get into the TV realm. And I realized, whoa, wait a minute. First of all, it takes like six people to get anything done in television.
That's
you need
right.
a sound guy. You need yep. a camera guy. You need props guys, you know. And then on top of that, I was noticing after a couple of years in television that the really good-looking anchor people would come in like an hour before they went on the air and leave 20 minutes later and get paid $400,000 a year. And those of us who'd been there 12 hours a day already were getting like, you know, one-fifth
right,
of that.
Right.
And I said, you know what? Maybe I'm going to go back to radio. I had more fun there. So
Smart move.
I caught the bug early and stayed with it.
I spent 4.5 years at Oprah Radio, which it's a title, but I don't know that I'd call it real radio. It was on Satellite XM. Yeah. And we had working with all the TV people. And what you said multiplied by, you know, 1,000% of the comings and goings. And I would see them upwards, of course, at that time with the Oprah show on television, you know, 30, 40, 50 people to produce an hour.
Right.
And I admire it, but I really wanted nothing to do with that. I've already been in radio for quite a while at that point, but I was fascinated at the difference of delivering messages in these two very opposite mediums. And you're right, radio is basically a slam dunk. But I met you at WGN, and one of the first things that I realized, even though I'd been on the air for a while, is that a good host always needs someone who can hear what the host cannot. And the first time, you probably don't remember this, but I do. The first time I had to come in and do some promos in your studio, you ran me through the ringer like 6, 8, 10, 20 times. Man, do this and turn this and turn left and turn right. Because you're hearing things that we can't hear. Has that always been kind of an innate talent for you?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I learned early on from some very talented mentors that basically what you're doing every day is reverse engineering your content for the people you're targeting, you know? And, you know, at WGN, it actually took me about a year to really, you know, get to know who is listening out there, what we should say to them, how we should deliver it. And so I did a little gatekeeping, and I'm like, yeah, you know what? Why don't you try this instead of that? And really the central theme to how I believe not only the content, the live content like your show or your podcast, but also recorded stuff, imaging, promos, commercials. The heart of quality there is talking to people and not at them. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's very easy to talk at people on the radio.
Yeah.
And just, you know, boom, right over their head, or they're not really tuned into you. You have to talk to them. And that's a talent not just that I've tried to perfect, but I think that all great communicators in radio have successfully achieved.
When you were a kid growing up, was there somebody you listened to and thought, huh, I'd kind of like to be involved in that? Was there any voices that come to mind that were an impact in you?
Oh, absolutely. You know, like I said, I grew up in the sticks up in northern Michigan, which was as small market as you can get. But every summer, I'd be shipped out to Boston to hang out with family. And I discovered when I was about 12 or 13 that I could actually tune in a Boston radio station in northern Michigan, WBZ Boston, 10:30 a.m. And there was a guy named Larry Glick who did the night show there because, you know, the AM signals travel great distances at night. And I loved Larry Glick. And then when I became, you know, mid-teens, I spent my summers on Cape Cod. And Cape Cod, Massachusetts, is within the daytime signal of WNBC New York. And suddenly I was treated to, we're talking 1984, 85 here, I was treated to Don Imus in the morning and Howard Stern in the afternoon.
Wow.
And I was hooked. I was listening to these guys going, oh my God, that's what I want to do. I'm maybe not exactly what they're doing, but I want to be a part of that craziness and that, you know, way to communicate. You know, because I was kind of a shy kid, got bullied when I was a little kid, and their confidence on the radio, you know, they're just their smartassery and confidence just really, really talked to me and said, hey, you know, this is the way to go through life, is to be sure of what you're saying. And ironically, if you've seen the Private Parts movie about Howard Stern, Kevin Matheny, who was his program director at WNBC in the 80s, the guy who helped hire him, actually hired me into WGN, the late, great Kevin Matheny, or Pig Vomit. As Howard referred to him in. But so that was kind of a big career circle for me, getting hired by the same guy whose station I adored when I was a kid.
Wow. You know, talk about Howard Stern. Talk about a guy who went from something to everything to more. I never would have guessed he'd be end up doing, what is it, America's Got Talent or whatever. I mean, come on. Well, talk about reinventing the wheel over and over again, huh?
One of my favorite lines in using with my comrades in radio is, there are two guys who live in $50 million mansions on the beach in Palm Beach. One is Howard Stern. The other was the late Rush Limbaugh. Clearly, they knew what they were doing. The rest of us were just throwing darts.
That is a really... really good way to put it. And this is a great segue to, I think, the meat of the conversation, Duff, that I wanted to have you on, because like you, and we have a similar mindset about this business, about the somewhat of a responsibility, I think, that comes with the microphone. And I was back-to-back with Limbaugh for about 4.5 years up in Michigan and syndicated out west. He was on from noon to three. I was on 3 to 6, two diametrically opposite voices. But one of the things I learned about him was he was a phenomenal broadcaster. Whether I agreed with him or not, because I was in the business, I didn't get hooked into all that because I was on the backside of it. But from a pure broadcasting standpoint, how to handle the show, how to handle callers, how to handle topics, there wasn't many people better than him.
Well, to a certain extent, I agree with you. You know, I politically was opposite of Rush Limbaugh, and I think, no, I don't think, I know that, you know, the degradation of civility, we'll call it, on radio and maybe in our culture kind of, you know, can be traced back to that mm-hmm. era. I think Rush was not nearly as impulsive and fraudulent as some of the guys doing it today are. I mm-hmm. think he actually had a limiter. And, you know, another thing is I lived in West Palm Beach for 10 years, so I crossed paths with him. You always had to wonder whether Rush actually believed what he said.
I was hoping you'd say that.
Perfected
yes.
the art of talking to a certain audience, of yes. reverse engineering what they wanted to hear,
yeah.
like I said, and doing it. I'll give you an example. You know, Rush was, for years, you know, I mean, you could actually say he was anti-gay. Mm-hmm. He once called gay people degenerate malcontents.
Yep.
He was very much against gay marriage. And yet, and he was very pro-sanctity of marriage, and yet at his fourth wedding reception, he spent $1 million and hired Elton John
right.
to play the wedding reception.
Right.
You know, this gay married man. So,
yeah.
you know, I always wondered just exactly how much of his own stuff he believed. And he did, I will say this, he did have a reputation in West Palm Beach of being a very nice guy, yeah. being very generous with tips.
Yeah.
So, you know, I just, he could come across like a bore and an ass on the air, but, you know, and I think that first generation of talk radio hosts, we'll call them, you know, Rush Limbaugh, Glenn Beck is another one.
Mm-hmm.
When I worked with Randy Rhodes, she told me the story of how she did a TV show with Glenn Beck once. And here was a guy who had literally insulted her and called her names on the air and gone after her. And suddenly she finds herself in the green room of this talk show on TV, cable TV, with Glenn Beck. And he's charming to her. You know, he's like, hey, I'm Glenn. Nice to meet you, blah, blah. As if all the things he said didn't matter, you know?
Yeah.
And so I think that first generation of conservative talk hosts understood it was kind of an act, you know, that mm-hmm, doesn't mm-hmm. let them off the hook, but necessarily, you know, they left work at work, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. And what you bring up a great point, Chris, because that leads us into the next step, which is, you know, I don't think that money is everything, right? So if you can pull that off, I could never do it. I could never BS people enough to,
me
neither. Right? I just couldn't do it. I don't know if I admire them for being able to do it. You know, if you're getting $40 million a year and lifting a $50 million mansion, you're not going to all of a sudden become, you know, something different. It's not valuable or viable to do that.
I agree.
You know, so I look at those things and I say, that's who they are, and you get it. And, you know, Howard Stern to some degree as well, this reverse engineering. This is a guy, when I started hearing him, I thought, this is like these kids I saw in high school that were saying things that they wish they could have said, and now this guy's saying it for him on the radio, and he's got these hordes of listeners. But I do know that when he moved over to satellite, they were expecting, you know, the in mass that his legions would follow him. I don't think it quite went that far, but he got a great deal. And I think, and for me, I knew that's what was coming next for Oprah. They were coming for her at some point. I actually, in 2004, kind of laid out the first grid of the Oprah Radio Network, and 2 years later, it actually happened. So you watch these trends and stuff, but I was never able to cross that line to bullshit people enough to say, here's who I am on the radio, and I'm totally different offside because I get a check. But yeah. But now you made a great point that these days, that line is so blurred, and I don't know if a lot of these guys who and women who are throwing shit against the wall are consider themselves entertainers. If they do, they're really got the lines muddled.
Yeah, well, you know, Rush and Glenn and the first gen, what I call the first generation of talk hosts, you know, were kind of the trendsetters. But, you know, then we started down this sort of unfortunate spiral in commercial AM talk radio. And by that I mean we started chasing away people. I'll give you an example. You know, over the last year, I mean, I've seen you on Facebook. I know you are at times social media active.
Mm-hmm.
And I've noticed this with other friends too. you know, you've got that one conservative friend who just won't let up, right? Every post, every response, every comment. And the standard tactic in 2021 is, you know what, I had to block him or I had to unfriend him because I just couldn't take it anymore. Mm-hmm. I've heard that so many times from family members talking about other family members, from friends talking about friends. I've had to do it a couple of times. People who just won't relent. Well, what I'm talking about is the entire talk radio industry in the 90s. You know, when you pointed out that, hey, you know, Rush Limbaugh's calling women Nazis and, you know, he's really kind of crossing some lines here, and he did frequently, and it made the media. Is, are you sure you want to go down this route? And more to the point, are you sure you want to hire other people who are just like him? And the response I always got from programmers, relax, just chill out. It's just entertainment. But we didn't realize that we were doing in the 90s what is happening in social media now. Mm. We were chasing away listeners who had listened to talk radio for years because they just didn't want to hear it. They didn't want to deal with it. Mm-hmm. There were plenty of people, obviously enough to make millions and millions of dollars that were like, yeah, go, yeah. But, you know, the deal with the devil was we were chasing away people and listeners who didn't want to hear it, and they were not coming back.
Yeah.
And I think that's, you know, kind of why it's my opinion that, you know, AM talk right now, commercial AM talk anyway, is kind of in a death spiral.
Yeah. You know, great points made. And I keep thinking of using the late Rush Limbaugh's audience, for example. You know, when you start cloning Limbaugh to some greater or lesser degree, you're really just going back to the same pie over and over again, the same audience with more of the same. And I'm not even talking since he passed away, but over the years, you started seeing other, what they call them, the wannabes, the Rush Limbaugh wannabes or whoever it is, get the knockoffs, and they're popping up in smaller markets and they're feeding the same audience. And there's only so many people in that audience. All of a sudden, you know, one of the things I do know about Limbaugh's audience is that people used to listen because they hated him, right? So you get the people that didn't like him calling in and listening and arguing with him, and he loved that. And then you have the core group who couldn't wait for a caller to come in and rush to lambaste him or whatever.
Well, so that's right? Part of the formula.
Sure it is. Sure it is.
You know, you mentioned through the years over talk radio and the proliferation. And, you know, I've worked conservative and liberal talk radio. Conservative is way better at it. But what they do is it's very easy. It's a simple formula, and I think that's why so many wannabes have chimed in. You know, half the time, John, the wannabes are, you know, the morning show DJ from the top 40 station down the
right.
hallway,
right.
who just got too old to give away Justin Bieber tickets and wandered down to the talk station and said, hey, I can do this talk stuff.
That's right.
And the formula is this. It's very simple. It's insidiously simple. You go on the radio in front of the microphone every day at a certain time. You discuss your point of view, your opinions, what you think matters, what you think is right. And you take that side in the argument. And then, John, you take the other guy's side. You give both sides of the argument. And that's why Rush Limbaugh, as legendary and as rich as he was, never had any serious guests of any substance on.
Mm-hmm.
And that's right. why more than conservative or more than right wing or more than traditional, more than these words, the word you heard out of his mouth, or the phrases you heard out of his mouth the most were liberals and the left, because he spent most of his show defining what he wanted his nemesis to be.
Mm-hmm.
When you argue both sides of an issue, you will guarantee that you will always win. And you come across sounding like a genius.
Yeah, that's right.
And everybody who agrees with you tunes in every day to hear your wisdom.
That's right. That's
it's an intellectually dishonest method. It's not a particularly talented method. Or
profitable.
It requires a lot of skill. But it is at the core of talk radio.
Yeah, it is. And it's very profitable. And once you start the machine coming in with the cash, deviating from that for most programmers, stations, networks, they don't, that's not going to happen. And
well, you know, that was
a great degree.
Part two of the perfect storm.
Yeah.
You know, you and I have sat in the last 25, 30 years and watched the consolidation of the radio industry where three or four companies come in and buy up everything.
Yeah.
And thank you, by the way, to Bill Clinton. You know, the Telecom Act of 1996 has his signature on it.
That's
and that
right.
really was the catalyst that sort of made these big corporations come in and say, look, we're not going to play to win. We're not going to be innovative. We're not going to be revolutionary. We're going to play not to lose and to make that bottom line every month.
Right, right.
And to do that, we're going to do what works. Not necessarily what we think is going to work or some crazy new thing that will be a hit down the road.
Right.
No, we want to do what works. And so they always fell back on, you know, let's do some conservative talk.
Yeah.
Or let's do some sports radio. Or let's do some brokered business stuff. You know, they really is just an amazing lack of innovation in the radio industry when it comes to, you know, a commercial radio industry anyway. I think so many people have switched over to public radio now for actual thoughtful content.
Well, you know, you talk about thoughtful content. You know, I know that you, and we'll come back to this in a second, but I know you work with, and somebody who really, I think, in a lot of ways broke the mold, and Delilah in particular, her calling has reached millions of people. You don't see that duplicated very often, though, which is
I
the opposite.
Her show for 2 years.
Right.
You know, she's a an intensely Christian person, and I think at times over the course of her career, some radio guys have said, hey, you know what? Because I know they did this to, what's her name, Dr. Laura.
Yeah.
Dr. Laura was like the advice lady, and all of a sudden somebody come in and said, hey, you know what? Start giving advice on abortion and gay rights and things
right.
like that.
Yeah,
Start
yeah,
making
yeah.
it political. And she did, and she petered out. She had a successful couple years. But I know that they've come to Delilah and said, hey, you know what? Why don't you take a stand here, take a stand here. And I know Delilah really well, and she's like, I have made so many mistakes in my life, moral and otherwise, that I have absolutely no right whatsoever to tell anyone else how to live their lives. So she's always stayed true to talking to, again, reverse engineering her message to people, and that's not part of it. It's far more personal than that.
Yeah, it is a good point, too, because there are many people that would love to take the next leap. Okay, I will become political. I will take these stands because I already have a big audience. But you're going to lose a lot of those people in risking that. And smart move on her part. I remember one of the first times I heard her late night. I was driving somewhere, and I, you know, you hear these people calling in with these difficult situations, and all they want to hear, Duff, is a song. They just want to feel a little bit better. And there's a huge wide swath of AM listeners, late night radio people, who live and hang on that stuff. When I came back from, when I was done with Oprah Radio and I had the opportunity to come to WGN, the first place they stuck me was on overnights. I'm like, are you kidding me? You know what I've just done for 4 years? But I did it because that's part of the deal. And I was in the old studio in the back where Bob Collins was and Wally Phillips. I was so honored to be back there. And I think the first or second night I had a guy on talking about the loss of his father. He had written a book about the loss of his father. And, you know, we had, it's 3 o'clock in the morning, Chris. I'm like, I don't know who's listening, but here I am doing the thing. And the next morning at 7 a.m., right when I got off the air, 6 o'clock, whatever it was, Bill White, our former program director, calls me and he says, I lost my dad 8 months ago. That was the most powerful show I've heard in years. And so you never know who's listening. You know, it wasn't like I did it on purpose because I had no idea he was listening or anything like that. But I did realize in that moment, which I kind of had known over my career anyway, that if you do things that have great value and purpose, you're not going to pull in everybody, but that's not always the point to pull in everybody. It's to touch somebody at some point. And I think that over the years, Delilah for sure has absolutely lived up to that by just connecting with people. They want to be heard. They want to be known that that they're important.
She and I spent the better part of 2 years in the same studio every night together. I produced her show in Boston when she was just on one radio station. And I can tell you, she's the real deal. You know, we would be sitting there playing our songs and taking our dedications and, you know, play this for my friend or my boyfriend or we're getting married, you know, play this song, you know, very light, fluffy stuff. And then we'd get the call, Delilah, I'm 24 years old and I'm sitting here alone in my apartment with a gun. And she would look up to me, put the mute button on, say, play some songs. And she would go over into the corner where there was another phone. And sometimes she'd be gone for an hour.
Really?
You know, talking to whoever was at the other end of the line. And of course, we had all of the helplines, the suicide prevention lines and the addiction hotlines and everything. We had all those numbers right there too. But this wasn't somebody who, you know, that part of her job was too deep for her. You know, she wanted to pass it off to some underling. No, she's the real deal. And happily, karma has been very kind to her. So
yeah, very cool. I know you don't have much time, but I want to get to a couple more things. This is from Business Insider 17 hours ago, which today we're taping on the 15th. This airs on a Saturday. But 17 hours ago, at last count, at least seven radio hosts and high-profile anti-mask and anti-vaccine advocates have died from COVID. The radio hosts include Dick Farrell, Phil Valentine, who I actually knew a little bit, Bob Enyart, and Mark Bernier. And then they go on to these other guys that were kind of anti-maskers. But I find it fascinating, but not surprising, that you see these people on the air go rallying against this stuff and railing against this stuff and pushing against this stuff. And they're feeding the minions and they're throwing the red meat out. And then karmically, they die. And to a person, I went and kind of looked up each one of the stories. They all recanted, "I wish I woulda, coulda, and shoulda." And so this kind of falls in line, like you said, with the old school of the Limbaugh model, where you're push, push, push. But over here, you got people who are pushing so far that it costs them the ultimate price. And that's not entertainment to me. That's stupidity.
No, you're absolutely right. And, you know, that's why I carefully pointed out that the Rush Limbaughs and the Glenn Becks were the first generation. And we talked a little bit about the wannabes and the copycats all showing up over the years. And for them to be successful, they had to get crazier and crazier. You know, I mean, you probably are old enough to remember the days when all the whacked out conspiracy theories and, you know, Hillary Clinton is running a pizza place in New Jersey
right.
with, you know, child trafficking going right. on in the back. That was all the stuff of shortwave radio. That was all the stuff of these goofs sitting in a building somewhere.
Absolutely.
In West Virginia or Utah or Nevada somewhere where they were. You know, just, and you know, because commercial radio wanted nothing to do with them. Well, now commercial radio allows them to do that, you know. And, you know, it's funny, a friend of mine who works in radio and I were talking about this exact same thing last week when we did notice that these, you know, hosts were just falling left and right. And he quoted Tony Montana from Scarface. And he said, "Don't get high on your own supply." You know,
yeah.
And in the case of Tony in the movie, it was cocaine. But in the case of these, and you know, I'll say these are tragic situations where the hosts were getting high on their own supply of misinformation, of BS, bullshit, and you know, they were doing stupid things. And another thing is, you know, I mentioned that I don't think conservative talk radio is particularly difficult to do. I think you and I could be right wing if we could sleep at night.
Right.
You and I could be right-wing hosts tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
But this formula means that you basically have to abide by the worldview. You know, you have to go on the air. You have to say Biden is awful. You have to own a libtard or two. You have to, you know, say horrible things about socialism and abortion and every year. These are all requirements. And as long as you do it, you're in. You know, as long as you toe a very, very strict line, probably the strictest line in American culture,
mm-hmm.
you're part of the crew. You're lovable. But the minute you start cracking at the seams, well, then all of a sudden you're Satan. I mean, look at, you know, over the past year politically, look at Adam Kinzinger in mm-hmm, Illinois mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. Lynn Cheney, you know,
yeah.
these people, these Republicans that actually dare to say, you know what, I'm not a big fan of Donald Trump. And all of a sudden they're, you know,
right.
they're banished,
right.
you know, and the same thing can happen in media too. You know, if you're not towing an exact conservative, hardcore conservative worldview on
right.
your show every day, then you have risk of losing, you know, the people that are making you your money. So
I don't remember the name of the guy you mind up in Milwaukee for decades was the hard right line guy. And when the Trump stuff started getting stirred up, he took an opposite view and they basically ran him off the air.
Right.
Death threats, the whole thing. I'm like, so for 30 years, you're okay. But as soon as there's any speed bump in that you don't agree with this, and he took responsibility. He's like, I created these people.
Right.
They found me, I found them, and now I'm kind of paying the price. And to my knowledge, I'd have to look up his name. I can't remember, but he probably's done, you know, he retired in that city. He's like, this is not worth my life because I disagree with something.
Glenn Beck actually kind of had some epiphanies towards the end of the Trump years where he's like, I can't put up with this anymore. I can't do this anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he's very careful with his words, but you could tell that, you know, some of his hardcore values were sort of, and conservative values, by the way, were being assaulted by this whole new phenomenon coming from his right. And, you know, he had millions of dollars on the line, so I think he knew when to tone it down a little bit.
Sure.
But, you already brought up karma, and you could look at the deaths of all these people, and some of them were not nice people. I mean, one of these guys that just passed away, you know, back in the AIDS days, used to play on the radio,
I know,
read AIDS obituaries and play Another One Bites the Dust. I mean, that's entertainment? No.
Right.
That's cruel and awful. And, you know, these people, you could say it's the Karma World Tour 2021.
Right, right.
But the fact is that it's tragic, you know. They're dying. They're leaving kids, wives, family.
Mm-hmm.
And to pay the ultimate price for what basically is nothing more than a radio bit is pathetic.
It is. And last couple of things I got for you. So do you think, I mean, I already know the answer to this, and my whole purpose in actually having you come on the program was to kind of shed a little light behind the scenes, but do you think that the average listener, the person out there in the world that is driving around listening to AM radio or even FM, because there's not much talk on FM, but, doing the AM thing, they have any idea how much goes in behind the scenes to get them to stay tuned to that channel, especially even if it's not good for them, but to continually feed that? Do you think that they have any idea how much energy and effort goes into retaining them?
My answer is fairly straightforward. Guys like you and me, sort of. Folks older than us, less sort of. But my confidence, my hope is that as time goes on, younger people are going to build much better filters.
Hmm.
You know, I tell this to everybody. We are, 20, 25, 30 years into the information age. As a species, as a human species, we've only had the internet, which, let's face it, is anything we possibly want to know at our fingertips. We've only had it for a couple of decades now. And we don't evolve that fast as a species. So right now we're living in a perilous age where we've got millions of souls who have this incredible power at their fingertips and they simply have no idea either how to use it or the sinister plots behind it that are trying to control them. And I think as time goes on, if we live, that the next generations will be far savvier when it comes to, and far more maybe cynical and cautious about everything.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
When it comes to the quote unquote entertainment that they're seeing every day.
Oh. And the last thing is, I can count on one thing from you every year in June. The Indianapolis speech from Jaws somehow always crops up on Chris Duffy's website. If not, it'll be one line from the movie Jaws, and then about 3,000 people, myself included, we finished the whole script. Hooked on Jaws.
Yeah, I think, you know, to be a Gen X or young boomer guy in America, there are certain movie quotes you absolutely are required to know, and that's great stuff there, too. The ironic thing is it was how badly they fluffed with the date of when the actual Indianapolis sank.
Oh, I know.
They missed it by like 3 weeks.
I know.
And it's like, well, too bad they didn't have the internet back then. Somebody could have checked it on their phone.
That's right. And I've watched the behind the scenes of the Jaws docs a couple times. There's a few of them. I've actually had Carl Gottlieb on the show quite a few times. when I was at GN, I had him on. Everywhere I've gone, I've kind of dragged this guy along with me. He's in his mid-80s now, but very sharp. And he always tells some great behind-the-scenes stories about Spielberg and, you know, and Robert Shaw and you know, Richard Dreyfuss getting into it. Just, it's great stuff. And one of the things he talked about was, go ahead.
Oh, no, keep going.
No, I was going to say, so one of the things I asked him about that Indianapolis thing is, you have to understand something. That was rewritten like 3-4 times. People took a whack at it. I think John Milius took a whack at it. All these people were adding to that speech. And finally, at 3 o'clock in the morning or 2 o'clock in the morning, a very drunk Robert Shaw says, let's tape. So when Robert Shaw says, roll tape, we roll tape. And whatever he came out with, he said, the last thing we're going to do is effing change what Robert Shaw said.
I know. They were winging it creatively. And that's why I think they ended up with a masterpiece. Mm. But, you know, I mentioned I grew up on Cape Cod, spent my summers out there. And that's, of course, where it was filmed. And
sure.
When I was a kid, you really didn't worry about big sharks in the waters off of Cape Cod. And then in the early 90s, the seals out on Monomoy Point started to make a rebound. They started showing up again.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next year, there were more of them. And the next year, there were more of them. So fast forward to 2021, there's actually an app you can download on your phone that shows you where all the great white sharks that have been tagged in the area are swimming.
Terrific.
So, yeah, and of course, these are the ones that have been tagged. The ones that haven't been tagged, you got to worry about. But time marches on, doesn't it?
It sure does. It's, you know, you've hit a core of something when, you know, you got people walking around for 35, 40 years going, y'all know me? Yeah. You know what I do for a living? You know, after you watch this a few times, and I run into guys I haven't seen for years, and the first thing we do is greet each other with lines from Jaws. So something's definitely not right. Yeah. Chris, so great to have you. This has been a fascinating inside look. You're one of the few people I know that have played all sides of this game, conservative, liberal, you know, the production stuff goes without saying, the voiceover work, which is what you're doing a lot of now, all really very all-encompassing. I wish you the best in all this. And at some point, you know, as like I said, you know, there are certain voices you hear. Bill Curtis, our mutual friend, you know exactly what's going to happen after he starts opening his mouth. And the same thing with you. As long as I've known you, just when you said Cape Cod, I thought, I want to go to see Watch Jaws again. Just the way you said Cape Cod, you know. So
we're going to need a bigger boat.
That's exactly right. Chris, I appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you, John. The best to you.
There was probably a dozen or more directions we could have gone with that that conversation with Chris Duffy. He's a little bit of a time constraint, so I appreciate him taking the time out of his production schedule to spend time with us at Life 2.0. And the whole idea with everything that I've done on the air has the inform, entertain, and inspire components. If I can do all three of those in one show, I always felt like I had done my job. When you're doing 3 hours a day live, like I did for years, that's a little bit more easy to do because you can kind of break it up and you got commercials and a lot of guests and moving parts and all that kind of stuff. And I found, because the podcasting platform is very, very different than radio, you know, we're already at the sweet spot, about 40 minutes. That's the attention span most people have, if that, to get something across. When I was on WGN and Chris was the production guy there, you know, I'd be on from 3 to 7, if sitting in Gary Meyer's spot, or from noon to 3, or from 9 to noon or whatever. So you have that big chunk of time to really sit back and really relax and kind of go into things. And that's something that's usually on in the background of most people's lives. When I grew up, WGN radio was on from 5 o'clock in the morning till 10 o'clock at night, whether we were in the kitchen or not. There was the avocado green radio sitting on top of the avocado green Sears refrigerator, right next to the avocado green stove that was across from the avocado green dishwasher. So that was just on. My dad would flip it on. It would literally stay on. Never once was that channel changed. And there's a listening audience like that, but it is shrinking as it has inevitably over time with all these other platforms. So thanks for spending time, whatever you have to allot for this. I really try to keep these things to 40 minutes. When you're used to talking 3 hours, I could go on and on and on, but I've learned over time to pull that back to a greater or lesser degree and try to get as much in as short a possible time as I can, knowing that our attention spans have diminished greatly. When I did the Earth Matters thing with Bill Curtis for 3 years, I really was able to get a lot of information in a minute. And that was a real sweet spot. You take Bill Curtis's voice, you take some highly researched information that most people never hear, and you kind of shrink that down into 59 seconds and make it work. You know, it got to be an interesting process and all the moving parts that go along with that. Prior to that, I did, 6,000-7,000 minutes, standalone minutes called Power Thoughts. And same thing, you know, I'd write this stuff down and can I do it in a minute? Because that's sometimes all people need or all they have. So in this particular case, this podcast with Chris, if nothing else, I hope you take away that there's a lot going on behind the scenes. And for most people who, as he pointed out, are the casual listener, they just kind of don't just go with the flow of it. Here's what it is. But there's a whole track of people on this side of the microphone that believe this is just entertainment, that it's not going to hurt anybody, that there's no harm done as long as the check's clear. And I don't believe that. I think that we have a responsibility as broadcasters because of the microphone we're given, because of the platform, whether there's 9 people listening or 9 million. To me, it's all the same. And if I could lift the lid up a little bit on my side of this business, and again, I hammer this all the time, but to hear from Chris, then there is the use of my day has been well worth it, meaning I fulfilled that inspire, inform. The entertain part, maybe not all the time, but I want to inspire you to at least be more aware of what you're listening to or what you're not listening to and how that affects people and the narratives that are built into all this stuff for profit. This, the bottom line is money in this business. It is not about some great and glorious greater good. If you can pull it off like Delilah does, fantastic. But for the most part, that doesn't happen. You know, it'd be very difficult, I think, for me doing what I do now and knowing what I know now just to go in and talk about nothing, to fill time, you know, with going through the headlines and say, what do you think about this? And what do you think about this? And give me a call. And who's got the best hot dog? I did that for a long time. And there's a time and a place for it when you need to kind of, you know, get to the next piece of information you want to put out. But I've always felt when I walked out at the end of the day that if I was able to pass along some information or an awareness to people listening that would make their lives a little bit better or improved, then I did my job. And I hope you found that to be the case today. Until next time, safe travels. Adios.